The Ames Laboratory has its origins in the Manhattan Project, which produced the world's first nuclear weapons. The Ames Lab is now 70 years old. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Ames Lab is owned by the federal government and operated by Iowa State University under a contract with the Department of Energy. This hour, we'll retrace the origins of the Ames Lab with its director, Adam Schwartz. We'll also talk about some of its cutting-edge research with two of its scientists, Vitaly Pecharsky and Ivor Anderson. We'll talk about innovations such as 3D printing and new technology that could revolutionize refrigeration. The Ames Lab turns 70. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Ames Laboratory is 70 years old. The Ames Laboratory has its origins in the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project, of course, produced the world's first nuclear weapons. We want to dedicate the hour to looking at the origins of the Ames Lab and some of the really amazing research that's been done there in the past and that is currently being done there. A little later in the program, we'll talk with a couple of the scientists at the Ames Lab, Vitaly Pecharsky and Ivor Anderson. But first of all, let's start off by talking with the director of the Ames Lab, Adam Schwartz. He is not only the director, but also professor of materials science and engineering in the College of Engineering at Iowa State University. By the way, Ames Lab is owned by the federal government and operated by ISU under a contract with the Department of Energy. Adam Schwartz, thanks for coming to the studio.
Ben, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We want to reach out to our listeners this hour. If you have any questions about the Ames Laboratory, its history, but also the research that we're going to be talking about this hour in many different fields, please join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us river2river at iowapublicradio.org. Well, your 70th year there at the Ames Lab. Of course, you weren't there, Adam, at the beginning. But let's talk about the beginning, the origins. Before we talk about some of the notable things that have come out of the Ames Lab, what is the tie-in with the Manhattan Project?
So it turns out that in the late 30s and early 40s, Iowa State College, as it was known at the time, had particular expertise in the chemistry of rare earth elements. Those rare earth elements sit relatively low in the periodic table. At the time, they didn't have nearly the technological applications that they do now, and hopefully we'll get to talk about that a little bit later. But there was specific expertise in purification, in synthesis of these rare earth elements.
Mm-hmm. And so this is before anyone except some of the very best-known, most intelligent scientists knew there was anything such as atomic power, nuclear power, anything like that. We didn't know that these very dense elements contained that power.
That's correct. Research in the early 1900s was beginning to show that the nucleus of atoms contained an extreme amount of energy if it could be used or split or fused together. And that's really the origin of the Manhattan Project in World War II. The Manhattan Project needed high-purity uranium in order to further that process, and that is to enrich the uranium to make it useful for nuclear power, nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. So the Manhattan Project recognized that there wasn't expertise anywhere in the country in purification of actinides. Couldn't do anything with them. So they had to start somewhere, and they came to Iowa State College, and they spoke with Frank Spedding, professor of chemistry, world-renowned in the area of rare earths. Now, the rare earth elements, they sit just above the actinides, uranium, plutonium, and others, a little bit further down on the periodic table. And they came to him, and they said, Professor Spedding, we know that you're an expert in rare earth chemistry, in rare earth purification and separation. Do you think you can work on purifying uranium. And, of course, I wasn't there at the time, but I just sort of picture him shrugging his shoulders and saying, if you need me to do this, I'm going to give it a try.
Mm-hmm. So was he, do you think, at that time aware of what it would be used for, the implications of what he would be working on?
I don't know for certain, but I strongly suspect that he had no clue.
Okay.
He was just working on the rare earths and doing his science, and then that knock came on the door and said, we need you. And he and colleagues built a team and jumped right in. They went on to purify. They developed a process to purify uranium, the Ames process, that is still in use today. It is the most efficient way to purify materials, and that development of the process, ultimately purifying of uranium at Iowa State College, they purified about a third of the uranium used in the first nuclear chain reaction at the Chicago pile, mm-hmm. and then went on to purify more than 2 million pounds for the Manhattan Project itself before industry took over and began producing even larger quantities.
So when we get to the point of the test, the first test at the Trinity site and later the two bombs that were dropped on Japan, were those materials concentrated in Ames as well?
The Trinity test was not that I'm aware of. The Trinity test was a test of the first plutonium nuclear weapon. The one of the two nuclear weapons dropped on Japan had uranium as its explosive source. The other one used plutonium. So the uranium, I don't have knowledge of tracking of mm-hmm. the individual uranium atoms. I do suspect that much of that material probably had its origin, its purification here in Ames, Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more in layman's terms, as much as we could understand without being nuclear physicists, about this purification process, the Ames process, which is still in use today. What is the key to it?
So I'm going to turn this over to Ivar Anderson.
And
let him go into some of the details of the purification.
All right, Ivar, welcome to the program. Nice to have you on again.
Thank you very much. Good to be here, Ben.
I see your title here. I want to mention that you're senior metallurgist at the Ames Lab, also adjunct professor in materials science and engineering at ISU. Okay, the Ames process, how can we understand that?
Well, I guess it does go to some of the basic principles of chemistry. And I know from my connection to chemistry and to the Materials Preparation Center at Ames Lab, which still continues to practice, actually, the Ames process on the rare earths, the lanthanides that Adam was mentioning. We start out by taking the oxide, highly purified oxides, and in this case it would have been uranium oxide. And it is exposed to a high temperature in a closed environment, basically a platinum tube, in fact. And the atmosphere in the platinum tube is hydrogen fluoride gas. And that converts the uranium oxide. It would have converted the uranium oxide into uranium fluoride. And the uranium fluoride then would have been, as a particulate, you could say, sort of crumbled up and put into what's called a thermite reduction vessel. And thermite reduction vessel essentially puts this stack of these crumbles into the bottom of a steel pipe. And then at the top of that stack of powder would go pure calcium. At that point, the pipe would be sealed. And it should be said that there's an ignition source, typically like a spark plug, actually,
mm-hmm.
That's immersed in the powder. There's essentially they seal that pipe, and then they'll set off the spark plug. And there's a reaction then where the calcium grabs the fluorine from the uranium fluoride and forms a salt. A molten salt layer on top of it, And then the uranium itself gets hot enough in this exothermic reaction that it melts and solidifies in the bottom of the pipe.
Wow. Okay. So I think you could, based on your explanation, we could spend a semester studying the Ames process.
This is true.
But it is still the process that you said to still use. Was it developed in Ames?
Yes, it was. Yep.
Okay. Yep. Very interesting. So, Adam Schwartz, back to you as director of the Ames Laboratory. The Ames Laboratory has its role in the Second World War, and then it becomes a national laboratory. What happens?
That's right. About 2 years after the end of World War II, the Atomic Energy Commission at the time, that's now Department of Energy, was developing a national laboratory system to take on national scale challenges that typically individual university researchers, university professors wouldn't tackle. So Ames Laboratory was one of maybe a handful of national labs that were designated in the late 40s, early 50s to work on problems of significance for the country. Ames Laboratory's mission from the very beginning has been focused on creating materials. Our current tagline, we create materials and energy solutions. That has been a part of our history from the day Manhattan Project knocked on our door to what we are doing now to where we're going in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say we create new materials.
All right. Materials is the word to remember in connection with the Ames Lab. We'll be hearing about some of the fascinating research done on materials during this hour as we talk with the director of the Ames Lab, Adam Schwartz. Also, Ivor Anderson with us. We'll also be joined by Vitaly Picharsky, another of the scientists working at the labs. Your questions, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Adam, not until I looked this morning, I wasn't, of course, aware for a long time of the Ames Lab, but not aware of how actually large it is. You employ how many people there and how many scientists?
We have on the order of 300 full-time equivalents. So that would be folks who work 100% time at the laboratory. If you count the joint faculty, the students that we have, the part-time scientific staff that we have on the order of 550 or so staff and associates who participate in our mission of creating materials.
Mm-hmm. And if I would walk into your lab, into representative space of what you do, what would I see going on? People in white coats, people at cubicles or test tubes? What am I going to see there, Adam?
All of the above. And we would actually love it if you came out. I would personally take you around, show you some of the laboratories. We could put on demonstrations for some of the things you're going to hear about later. But yes, we have scientific staff, postdoc students, wearing all of their lab coats, their eye protection, their hearing protection, their personal protective equipment. We take safety very seriously, of course. We have many computational scientists, so they will be in offices or cubicles working on either developing new models, new algorithms in order to help us design materials better and faster and cheaper, or they're working on developing a model that might understand the fundamental chemistry or the fundamental physics of how the electrons interact with each other to create a certain performance, a certain property of a material.
Materials, of course, the key word for the Ames Lab. Let's talk about a material that the Ames Lab invented, solder. Tell us that story. Now, solder, I guess I can't even define it. I know I've actually soldered wires, but what is solder? I don't know.
Sure. I appreciate that, Ben. And actually, a lot of people, I'm certain, have used a soldering iron to melt the low-melting, basically tin alloys are the primary components that are used in solders. And the solder is meant to form an electrical contact, which is also a mechanical contact, between two conductors. And everybody has a phone on their body somewhere, and it's probably soldered with some of our solder, because there was a big movement in 2006 to outlaw the use of leaded solders in electronic assembly. So our solder was developed before that time, somewhere in probably 1992, I think, was when my student was first working on, 92, 93. But 2006 was a huge pull into the marketplace for our solder alloy.
Mm-hmm. And really trying to get lead out of all kinds of things, paint, and in this case, solder. So when you say I have a cell phone or anybody has a cell phone right now with some of the Ames solder, that is lead-free solder.
That's correct.
Okay. That's correct. What was the key to making solder lead-free?
We were primarily, my team and I were essentially looking for combination of metals, a formula or something like that, you could say, that would melt at a certain temperature that the industry was already using for leaded solders, and that the material also, what we call an alloy, would also have very similar properties, and it would be about as hard, about as fatigue resistant, things like this, that electronic joints have to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And we did what we always do in trying to search for new alloys is we opened up our book. There's a book of two component alloys, and basically picked a couple of those two component alloys, tin silver and tin copper, and said, what if they were combined into a three-component alloy, and that was there was publication on this in the 50s by a German group, and it took actually looking at the original papers in German, and luckily I had a student who understood German, and we were able to determine that there was only one data point in the place that I thought was suspicious of a low melting point formulation, and we tested that across back and forth across that region, and came up with a combination that gave us previously undiscovered low melting point.
Mm-hmm. And in the recipe, so to speak, probably call it something else, has not been improved upon. Obviously, it's everywhere. So is there a patent on it by the Ames Lab?
Yes, there was, and that one was issued in 1996, so a full 10 years before the outlaw of lead, and if you do the calculation, actually, it has already expired. It expired about 2 years ago. Because at that point, that was one of the 17-year patents. Nowadays, patents are good for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the Ames Lab this hour. If you've just joined us, join our conversation. We have with us Ivor Anderson, a senior metallurgist at the Ames Lab, Adam Schwartz, its director. Also, we haven't heard from him yet, Vitaly Pecharsky. Welcome to the program.
How do you do, Ben?
Distinguished professor of materials science and engineering at Iowa State University. Well, let's talk about critical materials, replacing rare earth elements, trying to do the same things. So who can give us an introduction to critical materials, examples of these type of materials that we usually mine?
I think Adam is best.
Adam, jump in here. What is a critical material?
All right. Well, a critical material is really anything that you don't have enough of when you need it. I think of critical materials the same way I think about finances, and that is, what do you do if you don't have enough? You either make more or you use less.
Mm-hmm.
Critical materials are anything that the world needs but is in short supply for one of many, many, many reasons. Either its use has increased dramatically very, very quickly, and the mining industry has not been able to keep up with that. Or it's simply in very scarce supply within the Earth's crust. Or it was plentiful, it is plentiful, but there might be geopolitical concerns that make the availability of it at risk. In the example of critical materials that we are currently studying now through our Critical Materials Institute is the rare earth elements. The rare earth elements are somewhat of a misnomer. They are not particularly rare in the Earth's crust, but they are not geographically located in high concentrations the way iron might be, the way copper might be, the way coal is. So the world has rare earths in its crust. It simply does not have it very concentrated, or it's only concentrated in a few locations.
So there aren't really deposits like there would be of other materials. It's just spread out. Can I find some in my backyard, rare earth materials?
You probably could find some in your backyard if you dug down a little bit, but the concentration would be very, very, very small. And let me give a couple examples of what the rare earth elements are. Common names like neodymium and dysprosium, europium, terbium. Words you use probably every single day in your common language.
Yes.
Those are the ones we're talking about. Not very common, like copper, silicon, iron, but they are incredibly important to all of our electronics industry.
Why? Why? What do they do? What's so special about these little guys?
For example, neodymium, when combined with iron and boron, makes one of the most powerful magnets out there. The invention of these iron, neodymium, boron magnets, and you throw in a little bit of dysprosium if you need high temperature, they are so powerful that they helped enable moving from large headphones that we used to have in decades ago to the earbuds. Basically, these magnets pack more magnetic strength into a smaller volume than anything else. So that enabled the earbuds. It enabled small vibrate functions on your phone or your iPad, and has allowed things like automobile doors to be thinner to save steel. They used to be thicker because you required a bigger magnet just to power the speaker. So these elements, neodymium and dysprosium, are key for modern-day technology. They're also used in pretty much every single hard disk drive. There are billions of hard disk drives out there. So a critical material is something we don't have enough of. 30 years ago, the U.S. was the number one producer of rare earth oxides at a mine in Southern California right on the Nevada border. But over the subsequent 30 years, China discovered that they had pockets of rare earth elements, and they entered that mining industry. They might not have paid as much attention to worker safety or environmental concerns, but over those 30 years, they basically took over the entire market. And by 2010, they controlled about 95% of the worldwide market.
And our production had died out because they could produce it cheaper, faster?
Exactly right. We had that mine went bankrupt at least once, if not multiple times. Mines in Canada and Australia also shut down simply because they were not competitive price-wise.
Okay.
And then in 2010, China and Japan got into a spat over a Chinese fishing trawler. And
that's where we're going to have to leave the story. We're going to come back in just a minute. So let's pick up with that spat over the Chinese fishing trawler. That tells part of the story of the Ames Laboratory. Materials is what they do, and they've done a lot of amazing research with materials over the year. Adam Schwartz with us, the director of the lab, along with Ivor Anderson and Vitaly Pecharsky with us this hour. Stay tuned, because when we come back after the second hour, we'll not only hear more about rare earth elements, finding replacements for them, but also we're going to talk with Vitaly Pecharsky about choleric cooling, if I said that correctly. It's a revolution coming perhaps to your refrigerator soon when we talk about innovations at the Ames Lab, which is turning 70 years old this year. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In our lens today, the Ames Laboratory. It's owned by the federal government, operated by Iowa State University, under a contract with the Department of Energy. It's 70 years old, its origins going back to the 1940s. Today we have with us Adam Schwartz, its director, also professor of materials science and engineering at ISU, Vitaly Picharsky, distinguished professor of materials science and engineering, and Ivor Anderson, senior metallurgist at the Ames Laboratory and also with a faculty position at ISU. Join us with your questions. We hope to get to a caller or two a little bit later in the program, 1-866-780-9100. We're lingering over the fascinating history of the Ames Lab, Adam, earlier on, and we were getting to some of the major innovations here. Critical materials, we want to get to refrigeration innovation, talking about that with Vitaly and Ivor, talking about some 3D printing powder innovation. But first, finish up that story. We were had a dispute at a Chinese trawler with the Japanese.
That's right. The Japanese detained a Chinese fishing captain after venturing supposedly into Japanese waters. And as a result, China imposed export quotas, and the prices went up by a factor of 2, 5, 10, maybe even 50, virtually overnight.
After they had cornered the market on these materials like neodymium
yes,
and so forth.
That is exactly right. So imagine that you are a producer of magnets or phosphors or using rare earths anywhere, and all of a sudden your supply has been cut off. That's a big problem. So the United States, Japan, European Union all responded by increasing their research into critical materials. The United States started a critical materials energy innovation hub. Ames is the leading institution on that. It's a combination of 4 national laboratories, 7 universities, and many university partners and affiliates. And the goal is to assure supply chains of materials that are critical to clean energy technologies.
Mm-hmm.
So that Critical Materials Institute focuses on diversifying supply, and that really doesn't mean digging more out of the ground. It means once you have acquired that rare earth oxide, how do you separate the good material from the dirt, and then how do you separate one of those rare earth elements from the other? It turns out chemically they're very similar and very, very challenging to separate. So that's one aspect.
Mm-hmm. Ivor Anderson, I know one of your areas of expertise is working on magnets. Does it have to do with some of these rare earth elements, or is that in a different direction?
Actually, yes, our magnet project is a non-rare earth, high-strength permanent magnet project. It's intended, and we've been going on this for 8 years, actually. It's intended to be able to supply high-strength permanent magnets that don't use rare earth into the drive motor market for electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles. We're using a very historical magnet that used to be used for collecting barbed wires in the stomach of cows, Alnico, which is aluminum, nickel, cobalt, iron alloys. We've been doing a considerable amount of work on this through my graduate students and my very large research group now. We also are a collaborative project with Oak Ridge and a magnet company, Arnold Magnetics, and also University of Nebraska.
Okay. I have to ask, how does barbed wire get in the stomachs of cows? We have a lot to cover, but I can't just let that one go.
Okay. Well, if anybody's been around cows, they know that cows eat almost anything that's in front of them. And if there happens to be a piece of barbed wire that gets stuck in a hay bale, for instance, they will eat that along with the hay.
Okay. Very good. Okay. On to the main event. So these magnets, where does that get us to have non-rare earth elements in magnets, not having rare earth elements? What does that do for us in our cars, for instance?
It's a way, actually, for the automakers to rely on a supply of similar-priced magnets. This is a key thing for the automakers, that they be able to predict what their materials will cost several years ahead of time. so that they can schedule the production and buy the materials. And so they want them. They want a magnet in the marketplace that has multiple suppliers and multiple sources of the raw elements in there. So this is meant to. We're working on basically getting these magnets strong enough so that they can be used for these high temperature permanent magnet motors. And those operating temperatures are really right at the edge of the neodymium iron boron systems. Like Adam was saying, that they needed to spike in a little bit of dysprosium actually to bring their performance up at 180 degrees C, which is typically their maximum operating temperature.
Mm. Vitaly Bicharsky, I want to jump over to you and talk about a project you're working on. It has to do with refrigeration. What is the future of refrigeration? I guess compare it to what we have now. What kind of leap do you hope we're making?
Well, obviously the future is bright. Well, we use refrigeration routinely, daily, and it's used for everything. It's air conditioning, refrigeration, freezing, and it's a very reliable, very old, very refined technology. There is one problem. Actually, there are two problems. One, it uses relatively substantial amount of energy to run. Cooling is not cheap, and those of us who live in Iowa in a hot, humid summer, we know that our air conditioning bills go up substantially. That's because we are using air conditioners. That's one problem, energy. Second problem is all of the refrigeration devices that we use today, they run on liquids. They're volatile liquids, which are fluorinated, chlorinated hydrocarbons. And the way every air conditioner, every refrigerator fails is there is a little crack developing in a heat exchanger.
Right.
And because the liquid is volatile, it escapes. And it escapes in the environment. And if you ever had to repair it, today, replacing Freon is not cheap.
And if you've ever, Vitaly, been on a summer vacation and come back with your three kids and then not had any air conditioning,
then you get to know Freon.
And that's
a huge problem.
And how much it is to repair that and replace it.
It's expensive.
Yeah.
So what are we working on? We're working on an entirely different technology which uses solid-state materials. Once again, it all boils down to materials. We are getting away from liquids. We're no longer going to use liquids in the future. There are several classes of solids which will change their temperature when you act upon these solids with a different field. It could be magnetic field, goes back to magnetism that we talked about today. Could be electrical field. We didn't talk about electrical field at all. Could be even stress field. Basically, either squeeze or zap or magnetize, demagnetize material. And once you have a temperature change, then you can use this temperature change to actually produce cooling and, importantly, heating, because, not surprisingly, every refrigerator has two sides. It has both the cold side and the hot side. And given the fact that you can change the temperature of a solid much more efficiently when you need to compress and evaporate the liquid refrigerant, that's where the energy efficiency comes from, and then it becomes really cost-effective to both cool the house and heat the house using what we call caloric cooling and heating technology. So that's an exciting project that we're working on. And
how far are you in it? Does this exist?
Well, we just started in terms of materials. Answering your question whether it exists or not, there have been a number of laboratory-scale devices built all over the world. I would estimate close to 50 or 60. No pre-commercial prototypes yet. So the bottom line is the technology is proven in the lab, and it all boils down to the availability of materials that can do the work efficiently, effectively, to the satisfaction of a customer.
So Vitaly, you have no doubt that this will come to fruition, and with enough research, this is going to happen because it's been proven in the lab.
Or absolutely. I mean, there's no question it will become commercial. If you ask me when, I'm not ready to answer it yet, because first we need to create materials base. So it all is in the materials. Just another point of information, if you look at what is available today, Anybody who wants to design a caloric refrigerator is basically stuck with the number of materials which you can count using fingers of one of your hands. We only have total of four materials, which is not a situation which is good for development of technology.
And you're going to make another material that will just be amazing.
Absolutely. That's what we're set to do, and not just one material. We're looking into a variety of systems, and we just started about a year ago.
Okay.
The project is called CaloriCool, which Ames Laboratory leads once again. And within 4 to 5 years, our goal is to have at least one, maybe two, materials ready for commercialization by manufacturers. And, of course, we're planning to have many more materials chemistry in the pipeline to create a foundation for the technology. And if I may use an analogy that Ivor was talking about, lead-free soldiers. If not for Ivor's work, which was done about 10, 12 years before the mandate came to replace lead in soldiers, it would not have happened. And it's actually kind of similar situation, although I must say the refrigerator is a little more complicated device than the soldering iron. But still, it's all in the materials, and I think that's what Ames Lab is all about.
So Ben, I need to jump in here. Vitaly is being very humble about all this. What he failed to mention was that 20 years ago, Vitaly and a former colleague, Karl Geschneider, discovered the first giant magnetocaloric material ever. The phenomena had been known. They discovered this first one, and it was a remarkable discovery at the time. It is still one of those few that could be used. The problem with it, or the downside of it, is it contains some of those critical rare earth materials. Mm. So as Vitaly and team pursue finding the next best caloric material, they are looking for a material that is affordable, that is earth abundant, and that could be easily manufactured. And, oh, by the way, it has to undergo and withstand billions and billions and billions of heating and cooling cycles without falling apart.
Okay. So for those who have just joined us, of course, you can tell we're into some really geeky science, but very important science with Adam Schwartz, Vitaly Bacharsky, and Ivor Anderson of the Ames Laboratory. The Ames Laboratory is 70 years old. That's why we're getting in touch again to talk with these folks a little bit about their innovations over the years and what's going on currently. I have to ask you, Adam, before this hour gets away from us, we have another less than 10 minutes now. I want to ask you about funding. We've been hearing about national funding cuts, especially in the field of research. How concerned are you about your funding when we see the president's budget impacting research around the country? Are you worried?
When I take a look at the president's budget request and specifically the Department of Energy numbers and the Ames Laboratory specific numbers, yes, I am quite concerned. The overall budget for Department of Energy is down somewhat, not as much as many of the other agencies, but clearly not up like Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security. Ames Laboratory numbers look very bad. And if Congress were to appropriate at this level, Ames Laboratory would see some staff reductions. We wouldn't be able to continue to meet the mission of creating materials and energy solutions. We wouldn't be able to continue pursuing new magnetic materials. We wouldn't be able to continue to work on caloric cooling. We wouldn't be able to address critical materials going forward.
What would be the implications for our nation in terms of research with that money missing from the Department of Energy and the Ames Labs budget?
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
What would be the implications for in terms of our country leading research in the world compared to other countries?
Yeah, the United States has been in the leadership position in almost all aspects of science. Certainly, material science, U.S., has been a leader for decades. Other countries have been investing a significantly larger fraction of their gross domestic product every year, whereas the United States research budget relative to the GDP is going down. So the rest of the world is catching up. We in my opinion, it would be most unfortunate to just give up this leadership position by reducing federal support in research. The main problem to me is that it takes a very long time to educate scientists and engineers who can do this research to make innovation happen. And if the president's budget is passed, there would be dramatic reductions in staff, not only at Ames Laboratory, but all of the national laboratories. And many of these scientists would either look to find work outside of the science business industry. Many of them would go back to their home countries. And to me, that would be the biggest impact of all. The United States has invested tremendous amount of time, money, resources in educating and training scientists who could make the next great innovative leap. And with a budget that the president has proposed, I worry that that would break that system that we have. We would lose much of our talent, and it would go back to other countries, and we would lose our competitive advantage. And that's competitive for economics, it's competitive for energy security, and even competitive for national security.
Why, Adam, does this research need to be done in a national laboratory, government lab, a government-funded lab? Why not let this type of innovation happen in the private sector? We see all kinds of technological innovation in the private sector.
That is a valid question. And I would say 40 years ago, 30 years ago, the United States had some companies, some businesses that truly led the world in innovation. You can think of AT&T Bell Labs at the time. You can think of U.S. Steel Research. These were large, very large companies that chose to invest significant dollars, part of their profit, into the next generation of innovation that's going to keep their business going forward. I'm not an economics major, but over time, the pressures have moved, I imagine, shorter and shorter term to reporting profits on the quarterly basis, and the first thing to go is often the research budget. So right now, the U.S. industry does not have the researchers nor the willpower to invest in long-term research that may take 10 or 20 years to come to fruition, if at all. That traditionally has been what the federal government has funded, either through the Department of Energy, National Science Foundation, other agencies. And with a shift away from that federal funding, the U.S. companies don't have the resources or the people or the willpower to continue that research.
We have so many fascinating things on my notes that we're not going to get rid of, get to. I mean, Ivor Anderson, can you give me a minute rundown on what you're doing in terms of 3D printing powder innovation here before we leave? Because that's really fascinating. I wanted to have you mention that.
Absolutely. Yes, we are engaged in a very large project through the Advanced Manufacturing Office of DOE, Department of Energy, that is focused on essentially making ideal powders for the 3D metal printing growth, the technology. Right now, there's a barrier to fully developing 3D metal printing, and part of that barrier is actually the availability of metal powders at a reasonable cost. Mm. And the yield of metal powders that can be used out of the conventional production cycle is very low. It's on the order of 10 to 20%. So what we're working on is actually probably doubling or tripling that yield in our laboratory. We've been engaged in this kind of research for essentially 30 years here. Also, we've been working on some of the other properties of the metal powders. For instance, gas atomized powders they can be the low-cost powder.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of them have gas bubbles inside of them, as you can imagine, actually, because the gas process needs to be much better controlled.
Okay, and you've got 10 seconds for this answer. We didn't have ink printers 20 years ago in our home, so we're all going to have 3D printers, Ivor, in the next 10 years?
Let me put 20 years on that because we also have another project here that's concerned with exactly how you squeeze the best properties out of these 3D metal printers.
Okay, good. I lost that special spoon in my drawer in the kitchen. Now I can print up a new one, right?
Exactly, yes.
Adam Schwartz, before we say goodbye, give us a future view, provided you have the budget to do this for the Ames Lab in the next 10, 20 years.
You're absolutely right. Assuming that we have a reasonable budget, I think the Ames Laboratory is truly ideally positioned to make huge contributions in materials innovations going forward. We talked about a number of them in critical materials, in caloric cooling. Ivor was just beginning to touch on being able to customize and develop the ideal powder for the burgeoning additive manufacturing industry. An area that we didn't touch on at all is electronic materials. And if you'd ever like to have us back, we'd be thrilled to come back and talk about this. But quantum materials, these are materials that have absolutely unique properties based on their electronic interactions.
So much to talk about, left to talk about. And Adam, you did extend that invitation for me to come visit. I'll probably take you up on that.
That'd be great.
Sounds so fascinating.
Absolutely.
Adam Schwartz, thanks for coming into our studio along with Vitaly Pecharsky and Ivor Anderson of the Ames Laboratory at Iowa State University. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking the time.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben, for talking to us.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. And our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about summertime, not fun, well, fun, but also hazards connected with summertime fun and how to avoid hazards, whether you be in the water, on the farm, or on your bike. That's tomorrow on the program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.